Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is January 27th, 2020, and this is a supplemental installment of the podcast. That means it is a repost of an interview that I did with somebody else, and today's somebody else is just one of the most positive and encouraging people that I had the pleasure to meet through my work last year. His name is Chris McMillan. His show is called Truth Conduit. You can learn more about Truth Conduit at truthconduit.com. I met Chris through Richard Grove's autonomy program. We've talked a bunch in the last 6 to 8 months, and I just find him to be like a very sweet man. You know how sometimes men are sweet? And so I jumped at the chance to be on his show. And let me tell you, like, Chris is like somewhere around 25 episodes of his show, and he really came out swinging as far as creating a media presence is concerned. His first guest was James Corbett. He's interviewed G. Edward Griffin, the interviewer in some of my favorite interviews. Chris also interviewed John McAfee, right? Like, I thought you needed SEAL Team 6 to find that guy. And he's also talked to a whole bunch of my favorite people, people I love working with, Kevin Cole, Danny McCarthy, Jim Hood, Paul Verge. So if you're looking for a new podcast to try out, definitely check out Truth Conduit. You know, when I used to post videos on YouTube, one of the most frequent comments I would receive from people who were upset by the things that I was saying there would be like, this guy was probably just some shitty teacher. Those people were correct. At least between the years 2004 and 2006, I look back with a great deal of dissatisfaction about what I was doing as a history teacher at a private school. We're going to talk about that on the show today. I like this conversation because while I'm introducing myself to Chris's audience, it's a nice reminder. I think this is going to be in the title of the show about why school sucks, and it's also an update for this new decade. And if you are a new listener, this show is good for new listeners too, and you're wondering what my attitude is towards higher ed, you know, look, I think America needs higher education. I'm fully aware that all kinds of important research and positive developments come out of these institutions. I happen to live in a city with a very impressive higher education scene. Carnegie Mellon is here, the University of Pittsburgh. I've visited these places. I have been impressed. But I'm just hoping more young people will ask themselves, do I need higher education? And certainly there are some criticisms that apply to all of education, right? Like the cost and the opportunity cost. But when we're talking more about the cultural and social messaging that's going on in these institutions, it's important to remember, on the one hand, that it is a small percentage of people involved in any of that craziness. But that craziness that we see is a barometer of the messaging that has taken place in certain kinds of programs across the country. And it is also worth pointing out that it only took the activities happening in just a few buildings on the Columbia University campus 100 years ago to dramatically impact the shape and the quality of public schooling for this entire country for the 20th century. So it's worth paying attention to what's happening now. Because when Tom Woods, I remember when Tom Woods and I did that show, we're sitting there overlooking the Yale campus. When these people get power, look out. And they're seeking power and influence in politics, in media, in education, and in law. So I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I don't mind revisiting these criticisms. Because this was, on Chris's channel anyway, more of a biographical interview. I edited a fair amount of the conversation out because it's repetitive material. Not that everything in this show is going to be 100% novel, but it was certainly a few new angles that I thought were useful, so I thought I would share it with you today. Also, coming up this week, I am super excited. Tonight at 9 p.m., I reconvene with our friend Dutch for the Picture of the Month Club. We are going to be dissecting the film American Psycho. This Wednesday, I have my friends from Online Great Books, Scott Hambrick and Dr. Carl Shute. We are going to be talking about Marshall McLuhan's book, The Medium is the Massage. And I did not misspeak there. McLuhan's famous line, the medium is the message. This book is called The Medium is the Massage. You'll learn all about that coming very soon. And this Saturday, I am also reconnecting with Pete Quinones from Free Man Beyond the Wall. I haven't been on that show since the beginning of 2018. I loved the conversation that I had with him back then, and I look forward to digging deeper this time. We went back and forth over the weekend talking about what we're going to do this coming Saturday. And because I mentioned autonomy, that was where I met Chris and a whole collection of interesting, inspiring, encouraging, and challenging people last year. So if you want to learn more about that, there is a link in the show notes of every episode on schoolsucksproject.com. Remember to check out Chris at truthconduit.com. I hope your week is off to a great start. Thanks for listening, and here we go.
Parts today. I want to talk a bit about ideology, then a bit about the economics of education, and then about you. So are there any indications that there is a collectivist push in the American public schools and universities?
Yes, but I would say that the school environment naturally primes people towards leftism, which is where most of the collectivist thinking exists, right? There's certainly right-wing collectivism, but if we're just going by what's prevalent in American politics today, the school environment, which is poisonous in the social dynamics, it's filled with what most people there consider to be meaningless work. There's no real respect given for students' time or for students' privacy. There's certainly a lot of consistent, even if they are implicit, messages about not trusting yourself, not trusting each other, just by the way the whole system is managed. Schools are, you know, also, like prisons, very cliquey, where, you know, people feel a need to assert themselves as individuals, but they need to do so in the safety of a group, right? Like, people have a need to project some kind of individual identity, but because of the hostility of that environment, that's natural too. I don't think you can put that all on, you know, the toxic school environment, is that people gravitate to people like them. But we certainly see that in middle schools and in high schools today, that people want to be individuals, but they want to do it in the safety of a group. Interestingly. So while we're sticking with that, some aspects of good character, or one of the most important aspects of, you know, having good character, I think, and being happy in life is gratitude. And if you look at all the things that I laid out just, you know, in a couple of sentences about public school, it really promotes ingratitude, basically the root of modern leftism. Ingratitude and grievance. So I think that through that, even though there might not be for everybody explicitly promoted left-wing or collectivist ideas in K through 12 schooling, if we're just keeping it to, you know, the normal public school experience, we could deal with higher education next. Even if there's nothing like overt about leftist indoctrination or collectivist indoctrination, people are primed for that just because of the attributes of the environment, I think.
What do you mean by ingratitude and grievances? What's an example of that?
Okay, well, if you think about, that's how you spend a pretty formative 15,000, well, let's not just limit it to 15,000 hours, because even if you spend 15,000 hours in school between the ages of 6 and 18, school is much more of your life than just that time, right? Even like Sunday afternoon, which doesn't count in those 15,000 hours. But as the sun goes down on Sunday, you know, I remember being 12, 13 years old and going, oh, I got to go to school tomorrow. And it would affect my mood. And coming home from school and having to do homework and the time riding on the bus in the morning or in the afternoon doesn't count for those 15,000 hours. So school very much takes over a young person's life and forms a certain attitude in which I think it would be hard to feel like appreciation for life and happiness. And so people, you know, the angst of teenagers, that kind of thing, those people go into higher education, number one, needing to make some kind of meaning out of their lives, but really not often in the healthiest of mindsets to do so. And I think when I got to college, you know, I was hungry for something, and I didn't understand at the time that there was a whole like left-wing professor industry who was, you know, trying to indoctrinate people towards like collectivism and socialism and progressivism. So, you know, I found a college professor who I really liked. I was really impressed with his historical knowledge. As a result of that, I followed him politically because I think that the revisionist history in higher education, and it could be revisionist economics, it could be social sciences or now grievance studies. So young people are, I certainly know I was, are ready to receive and act on that kind of messaging just because of the angst that so many of us are left with when we finish the public schools. And, you know, we also see that there might be more overt indoctrination going on as well, because a lot of people leave these grievance study programs in colleges and they're told, go get a law degree, go get a teaching certificate, go into the public schools. Now, people who do this and become public school teachers, where they're taking ideas from higher education, you know, about social justice or about socialism and transporting it into the lower levels of school. The schools have always like leaned to the left because most teachers are probably oriented towards the left just because it's, you know, it's a union thing. And there's been a, you know, an alliance with the Democratic Party and unions for a long time. But there was nothing, I don't remember anything really overt in my K through 12 education that was like, support this, vote for these kinds of people. I didn't see that. And I probably would have been more attuned to that than most people. My dad was a conservative. He was chairman of the school board when I was in elementary school. But I was never, obviously at that age and that level of ignorance, I wasn't able to connect that to any kind of political opposition between, you know, one side or the other. So I think the point is that in the last 20 years, we've seen more of these ideas from higher education trickle down into K through 12 schooling. And to give the people doing this the benefit of the doubt, they see it as a noble pursuit to pass these ideas that they learned in college on to younger students, you know, things about like making them aware of injustice or about how great socialism compared to the evils of capitalism, you know, whatever they think, right? So in their best selves, they might see that as a noble pursuit. But I would also say that from my observation, a lot of these people, because so much of their ideology is rooted in ingratitude and grievance, there's also an anger or a hostility that they bring to that. Like, I like the thought of upsetting somebody's Republican dad by teaching their daughter about transgenderism, right? So we see phenomena like the drag queen story hour, which I would say is the best example of something like that. Have you heard about drag queen story hour?
Yeah, I remember that.
Okay.
Yeah. So we were talking about that in autonomy. Yep.
A lot of teachers are inviting the drag queen story hour into their classrooms as young as kindergarten. So in the most optimistic view, we could say that these are naive people who are trying to encourage tolerance. But in many cases, these are people who probably like the idea of using their ideas to get under the skin of the, as they would see it, the unenlightened. So I think that's a feature of that as well. A lot of these young teachers who are bringing these social justice ideas into the public schools
They're also just kind of taking essences of what they got in college, and they're being motivated more by feelings than by the scholarship of this. I also know, as somebody who taught high school, engagement is a problem. Like, you're going to do much better with student engagement if you're teaching in college, because kids are there voluntarily. They're more likely taking courses that they have a higher level of intrinsic motivation to pursue. And when you're teaching at the secondary school level, you want to be effective. And I felt more of a need when I was in that situation to sensationalize information. Like, I remember in 2005, 2006, being a teacher and talking about things like the Apollo hoax, 9/11 truth. Like, I was doing this in a school just because, you know, if I'm honest with myself, I was desperate to command the attention of that classroom. So if you think about that, not in the realm of like, you know, truth movements or anything like, but social justice and socialism is better than capitalism type thinking, teachers, in an effort to engage students, might sensationalize those things. And a great way to sensationalize things is to do an amplification of the enemies, you know, like men, like whites, like straights. You know, you see all this antagonism towards these certain types of groups. Who are the oppressors? All of that is bleeding into lower levels of education, and really right down into elementary school, where kids obviously don't have the wisdom or the intellectual self-defense to effectively counter the things that they're being told by teachers, right? While they're in a system, even if they're like oppositional or defiant, the consistent message of that system is the people who are at the front of the room are the people who know, right? Even if you don't like them, even if you fight with them, even if they kick you out of class and give you detention, they are the knower and you are the learner. So yeah, I'd say we've seen a lot of things trickle down from higher education, which has been in a leftward shift for pretty much the latter half of the 20th century, and that's accelerated in the 21st century. One of the reasons for that, a lot of older professors who retired, professors probably from the greatest generation, were replaced by baby boomers who were, like the social justice activists of today, motivated to get into education, to continue spreading this message. A lot of these baby boomers were motivated by like the student protest movements of the 1960s. So they took that new left ideology and they started bringing it into higher education in the 70s and the 80s. And obviously their spawn produces more of these people who are also told that, you know, go to the institutions where you can have the most leverage as far as power, which is higher education and government. And so they're repopulating. And we see that, okay, there was a political science professor at Sarah Lawrence University, and he started, and Sarah Lawrence is like a very, very left-wing school. He went out and he did this survey of about 900 administrators. This was relatively recently. He found that liberals outnumbered conservatives 12-1 in these situations. So, like, we're kind of leaving like libertarian thinking out of the mix here. But if we just want to deal with the two prevailing political ideologies in this country, a 12-1 outnumbering is still not good, because it's not showing a very rich discourse or diversity of ideas.
You mean 12-1 outnumbering the right-wing conservatives,
right? So
comparing, you know, in the dichotomy there.
Yeah
so where are we? We're not even in the scale, man.
Well, I mean, we would be mostly aligned, I think, with conservatives on a lot of economic ideas, which is very dangerous that there's no representation of that in higher education. So Abrams reported this to the New York Times, and his office at Sarah Lawrence was then vandalized for pointing this fact out, that this is a problem, a tipped scale in favor of liberalism. The fact that he thought that that was a problem got his office vandalized. Students were circulating petitions calling for him to be fired. He got harassment, all kinds of made up complaints against him. And then that ultimately came down to the president of Sarah Lawrence. He appealed to her to, like, hey, can you defend my right to free speech as, you know, an academic in this institution? And she wound up reprimanding him for reporting to the New York Times without her permission to do so.
That's unbelievable. That's the first I've heard this story. When did all this go down?
This was just in the last few years. And this is also, you know, Jonathan Haidt, in his book, The Coddling of the American Mind, did a lot of good work on this subject. Another political scientist named Stanley Rothman did a lot of studies through the 80s and the 90s on this. Ultimately, I think in the last couple of years, the study was of the top 50 liberal arts colleges in the country, and about half of them had no conservative representation on their staff at all. Yeah, that's progressively getting worse as far as, you know, balance of ideas are concerned.
That, for me, that's a lot of proof. I mean, there's so much more to this story, but what was the name of the professor at Sarah Lawrence?
Samuel Abrams.
Okay. Yeah. Definitely worth, you know, because all these links that you're talking about, I definitely will try to include into the show notes for this, mm-hmm. because this is a great point for reference, you know, for anyone who wants to look further into this.
And again, this is also a result of this, is these grievance studies departments have grown in the last, so that's cultural studies, gender studies, queer theory, critical theory, like, you know, the Frankfurt School outgrowths, critical race theory, whiteness studies is another one.
Are these actual studies in colleges now?
Yeah, as part of social sciences. Absolutely.
Okay.
So just the fact that you have such a slant in program design is obviously an indicator that the lack of diversity of ideas in the echo chamber it produces is a problem. But the people who operate in those departments or in those programs, that becomes an echo chamber of their own, where, you know, they just are continuously reinforcing each other's ideas, to the point where if somebody comes in from outside that with any, you know, different point of view, that person is almost alien to them, right? And they don't see, like, the idea of being, like, fair and balanced in education is not a priority in those programs at all. Their responsibility is to alert students to the injustices that exist in the world. And that very much becomes a one-track mind. So an example that we see in popular culture is when these people stray outside of their environments, they often just look like complete fools. So Tucker Carlson, who has a show on Fox News, loves to butt heads with these progressive professors on his show. Apparently, the word hasn't gotten out yet that if you don't go talk to Tucker Carlson, he'll make you look like a fool. I think these people, they say, oh, some idiot on Fox News, I'll go, you know, that would be easy. And they're completely unprepared to effectively counter any ideas that aren't theirs, because, you know, they're doing this, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all, with their students all day, who are just echoing their opinions back to them and reinforcing their. And I think that actually might be one of the reasons why people like teaching in those settings, right, is it provides that validation and reinforcement. But it's not just coming from the students. It's coming from their fellow faculty. It's coming from the insularity of their whole program. And it just gets worse and worse. So I don't think that the roots of the problem are particularly nefarious. It was just a matter of a bunch of greatest generation people who probably were more balanced, who were probably less ideological. Many of them could have been more to the right simply because they got into college in the first place through something like the GI Bill. They retired and they were replaced by a fair amount of 60s radicals, who then just multiplied and multiplied and multiplied by teaching, you know, the next two or three generations.
Is it because of a lack of logic and a lack of critical thinking? And as you say, just an echo chamber repeating what we've been told? Is this is a major factor, isn't it? What do you think? I mean, it seems like if you just sat down with someone, you know, that of that way of thinking and said, look at this, look what Larkin Rose is doing with his Candles in the Dark program, for example, just sitting people down and looking at logically breaking it down, because people are basically good people. They don't want to use violence to control other people. If you break it down and show them that this is what their belief boils down to.
Yeah, you know? No, I mean, I think it's possible. I'm not sure that higher education is a place where that, or even secondary education is a place where that's possible today. You know, I think that your original question was, do I see indications that there's collectivist agenda in public schools and higher education. And obviously at this point, you know, 20 minutes later, the answer is yes. But I think that people kind of gravitate to this naturally, too. I mean, we're tribal people. That's what collectivism is. And, you know, I'm of the belief that before human civilization existed, we actually spent most of our history in bands of people hunting and gathering, where living in a tribe or was absolutely essential to human survival. Right. So that is pretty much hardwired into us. Individualism is a luxury of the modern age, and I think requires deliberation and vigilance to want to achieve a more, you know, individualistic life or a more separate identity, despite what the cost of that identity might be. So, yeah, I think we're not just primed by school to be collectivists. We're primed by our very biology to be that. I remember this was a big deal like 5 years ago. There was a group of psychologists who went and studied Chinese political attitudes and linked them to the longstanding agricultural practices where they were. So in southern China, most of the farming, most of the agriculture is rice. Rice farming is a very communal activity, right? It requires a lot of close cooperation. In northern China, and then in most places in the West, the primary crop is not rice, but wheat, which is, I guess, something that can be done in not to the same level of communing that rice requires. Yeah. So if you look at some of the collectivist cultures that grew out of China in the 19th and 20th century, it could just be a feature of how they developed agriculturally that ultimately informed how they operated politically. So humans have that is, not rice and wheat farming. Most of our history, we didn't know how to farm. We survived by being a close-knit group. So we're all primed to tribalism, which is basically collectivism, which is basically subservience to a group. And it's a very easy thing to fall into. We saw in the 20th century, I think really, maybe for the first time in history, how dangerous that actually was. I mean, there's examples going back thousands of years for sure. Anytime that, people were united around some kind of common myth to fight for the interests of the few. But the 20th century was particularly bad. And I think that's when conversation and scholarship about individualism versus collectivism, even though it existed before that, that's where it became like, wow, this understanding this and picking sides here might actually be essential to the survival of our species.
Yeah, I doubt the Gulag Archipelago is essential required reading for high schools these days.
No, it's not. It's a big book.
Absolutely not.
Right.
Your journey from I was like you. I was on the I consider myself left wing. I was a big fan of Howard Zinn. I mean, I still respect his work a lot. And the same all the reasons you just mentioned, that was me. I was one of those. I went to high school, college, and from what I've learned from your previous shows, you were kind of in the same boat. What were some of the influences that kind of brought you to a more freedom-minded ideology?
Oh, what a question. So I went to college pretty much a blank slate, right? So I had no real critical thinking skills, and these emotional factors that I talked about in our previous segment there, that angst, right? So wanting to assert myself as an individual, wanting to make meaning out of my life, but not really having the wisdom or the courage to chart my own path in doing that. So there's plenty of like mostly left progressive political operations that seize on this opportunity in young people, right? Like, and I will get to your question in a second, but just some backstory on that. Like what happened at Parkland with that Parkland High School shooting recently, how all those kids became anti-Second Amendment activists. And some of them got really annoying about it, But but after I went through my period of antagonism, I went, geez, if I was 17 years old, I remember me at 17 years old. If somebody came to me and took me out of this meaningless existence and said, how would you like to be a crusader for the truth? How would you like to be a crusader for the good? How would you like to fight against evil? And how would you like national accolades for doing that. I would have jumped on that opportunity in a second, right?
Yeah,
and
me too.
And I think a lot of those kids did exactly that. So this whole climate strike is another example of that, where, you know, these kids are angry, they feel powerless, and it's like, well, here, you know, here's an opportunity for you to make meeting. We've made meeting for you. All you have to do, it's like a turnkey make meeting operation. We made it for you. You know, we'll give your life meaning. It's like franchising individual meaning, right?
Yeah.
Like your identity will be fighting against climate change. Your identity will be fighting against gun violence. So I think when I went into college, I was looking for something like that, even if I didn't know I was looking for something like that. I went and I did an internship about halfway through college working with a film company. My uncle was a film producer, and I worked with his partner in Boston. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in his office, and he had been involved in politics, and they made movies that, you know, had social messages. Like they produced Mississippi Burning, which was about, you know, racism in the South.
Yeah, that was with Gene Hackman, wasn't it?
Yeah, William Dafoe. Like, so kind of like beginning of the civil rights movement, South story. They did a quiz show, which was a movie very much about television and the impact of television. They did another movie called The Paper, which was about honesty versus sensationalism in journalism. And so I'm looking at the guy I worked for. His name was Nick Paleologus. He had been involved in education in school. I'm throwing up air quotes. He had been involved in education policy in the government of Massachusetts. So I was really inspired, like, gosh, you know, I need to do something with what I'm learning, with the privilege that I'm learning that I have in higher education, you know, to come from this background. Like, I have to give something back. I have to contribute to the world. And that was actually how I decided to, you know, instead of pursuing the communications career that I was planning on, I kind of shifted into education. I hope I'm not pasting my own story onto, like, the motives of so many people that I talked about earlier. But, like, I graduated from college and I walked out of the building with all the notebooks from my progressive history classes, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of them had, like, really great history in them, but it also had a political agenda embedded into it. So I, you know, worked as a general ed, special ed teacher for a while. I did outdoor education for a while. And working my way up through this school in 2004, I landed what I was sure was going to be my dream job, teaching history at the high school level. So I dusted off those notebooks from college. I wrote all my lesson plans out of the history and political and social education that I got in college. And I forced it onto these kids. And I've said several times, like, man, I didn't encourage a lot of critical thinking. I didn't encourage a lot of free thought. I was kind of a zealot about transmitting that information to them and sparking up their interest in history and also their awareness of injustice in the world, even though I didn't understand it fully at all. I had no idea how big the world of ideas was. So as soon as somebody came along with the confidence, you know, when I was in college, of like, this is what's right, this is how things work, this is not the Disney version of everything that you've been fed your whole life, I was hook, line, and sinker for that. And I didn't reevaluate that until I think I wanted to be a better teacher, right? I wanted to be more provocative. I wanted to be more sensational. And I think it's the same thing that's true with the social justice activist teachers today. You remember the movie Multiplicity, where Michael Keaton, like, makes a copy of himself? He clones himself?
Yeah, vaguely. I've seen it. It's been a while.
So he makes a copy of himself, and the first clone is, like, pretty good. But then he clones the clone, and then he clones the clone of the clone. And the clone of the clone of the clone is not a particularly useful human being, right? So, you know, I'm a copy of a copy teaching and making more copies. And I don't know what people did with that information after that. I shudder to think about how my teaching between, like, 2004 and 2006 might have affected some of these people. Because I was sensationalizing, I was over-dramatizing, I was operating much more on feeling than I was and trying to have, like, a holistic understanding of the great conversation or the world of ideas. Today, I think because of the echo chambers that exist, people are less likely to ever break out of that, right? And their identities are so wrapped up in what they're doing that they it might be just too inconvenient to see that there might be some error in their ways. But I was fortunate to be like in the right place at the right time and to start going online and consuming, reading, watching things that made me think in new ways and sort of expanded my view of the world. So at the time, I was very oriented towards the left, but I also started to get into things like 9/11 truth, right? So this was a very challenging expansion of like, yes, okay, so I'm primed for this by my ingratitude and grievance mindset that like the world is a totally screwed up place and everybody's out to get you and there's all this injustice. So you enter a story like 9/11. This was perpetrated by the government and the media against it. I was like, wow, what could possibly be a better story for angry young me? But through that, motivated by the interest in that, right, the sexiness or the allure of conspiracy, wanting to find out what was at the other end of that actually encouraged me to sharpen up all these learning skills that had been left underdeveloped by my schooling. And that was the point where I became, even though I didn't know the word at the time, an autodidact. Through that process, I actually had more of a willingness to integrate information that didn't align with my worldview. And maybe I was lucky enough that my worldview just wasn't hardened enough. It wasn't attached to my identity enough. I was seeking the best available ideas. So that was actually what took me from, because I remember being like a 9/11 truther, but also still listening to stuff like Media Matters, which is like a super far left. They had like an early podcast. This must have been like 2005, 2006.
Brett, I'm sitting here laughing because, I mean, your story is the same as mine. You know, it wasn't exactly 9/11 for me, but yeah, the same. I really liked that. It was a fantastic explanation. Your early work on basic philosophy, going back to Plato, really helped me, actually. You know, I was never taught philosophy, never took an interest in it. And then once I got into the works of Richard Grove and the Peace Revolution and all of the subjects that were covered there, I came across your work. And it was one particular episode that you did that was fantastic. And suddenly, it was after that episode, I was suddenly interested in philosophy. I suddenly got it. And I realized that's a big part of the problem as well is they don't teach philosophy. They don't stress philosophy in public schooling and universities as much as they should, if at all. Because, yeah, once I got wind of your work through the Peace Revolution, I said, this guy, you know, I really like what he's doing. So I went back to the beginning and I'm still making my way through. Of course, now I catch your latest episodes. There's so many topics out there that are so important that people really need to. I mean, you're an example of a proper way to go about things. You know, people just need to open their mind, argue with themselves, and start learning these methods. But the first step is to recognize how they have been processed like a can of sardines by the system. Nobody's going to snap out of it until they realize that there's something wrong. And until that happens, there's not going to be any progress being made. Speaking of which, I mean, we're going pretty quickly here with the time, Brett. I'm going to, just for the sake of time, I'm going to kind of skip number two here. I was wanting to talk about economics of education, but maybe that can wait. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the other day in your conversation with, I believe you were talking to Jim, there are areas in your life that you would like to achieve more freedom still. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I would like more financial freedom. You know, like I have total freedom with my time. I have total freedom, with my location. I have total freedom with my relationships. And I think that's something that, I often take for granted and remember that some people don't, you know, some people have like undesirables foisted on them constantly through their work or their commute to work or their family situation. And, you know, it was very important for me, and I think maybe my work experience had something to do with this desire, to be free of all of that, to not have to interact with people that I don't like or don't respect at all. The trade-off has been financial freedom. So I can live, you know, a pretty simple, modest, minimalist existence and really want for nothing. But that is also but kind of keeping my vision small.
Yeah.
Like, to not say, wouldn't it be nice to go to Italy for the summer, right? So, or wouldn't it be nice to have... It's making a lot of trade-offs and I think a lot of sacrifices that I don't want to make, right? And it also has to do with correcting a lot of mistakes that I made in the past, you know? Like, I was, again, in this the mindset of ingratitude and the mindset of grievance, which I took into the philosophy of liberty. I had bad attitudes about a lot of things that I probably should have been doing or not, things I shouldn't have been avoiding. And so now I've kind of gotten to the point where, okay, I see the consequences of not paying close enough attention to certain things I should have paid attention to with the respect to like personal finance. And I'm working slowly on trying to correct that. When people, and that would be like the greatest advice that I would give to people who are in their early 20s, get that right first. Build yourself a cushion. It's a cushion slash launch pad, right? Don't go out into the world and take crazy, uncalculated risks without, you know, having something to fall back on. Understand money, understand, you know, personal finance generally before, you know, you try to take on bigger pursuits.
That's a hot topic, Robert Kiyosaki, that I like, a message that I love it when he bashes the school system for that. He'll say it straight out, you know, the schools are not teaching people money, how to handle their money, how to invest their money. Do you think that could be intentional?
I don't think there's anybody there who really knows how to teach that. You know, if school is to make good citizens and school is to serve the political and corporate interests, having a bunch of people who are very financially free and deeply financially educated is not in the best interest, because those people are not dependents. And, you know, unfortunately, our political and economic system requires various dependencies. So,
and you could parallel that with the healthcare system and big pharma.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, school is a place where you learn to be a dependent. And I think there's plenty of people who have an interest in continuing that inculcation of dependency. I think it's probably in some cases it's sprinkled in with ideological factors, like just to talk about the student loan thing. Like we said we're going to skip that, but it actually relates to this. I can just go through it really quickly. Like, working on a continuum from most optimistic to most cynical, I think there are probably people like President Obama who would say, yeah, I mean, college is synonymous with success, right? That's a misconception that a lot of people have, right?
Yeah.
That a college education means a person is going to be more successful. And there's a bunch of cooked up statistics that suggest that, like, people who go to college make this much more money over their lifetimes, even though the college might have nothing to do with it, right? Correlation is not causation in that case. So they say, well, okay, then we need to make sure that other people aren't shortchanged when it comes to this opportunity just because they don't have the money to go to college, never mind why college is so expensive, which is entirely related to the student debt system that exists. But because of the cost of college, we don't want to rob people of opportunities. We want to make this money easily available. So that's like a more optimistic end of that spectrum. The more cynical end is like, you can't discharge this debt, right? So every student loan is a safe bet because there's no way to do, the people will carry the debts to their graves.
And that's, you know, probably why they hand it out so easily.
Well,
whereas, you know,
saying
a normal loan like a mortgage is really hard to get.
Well, because that's collateralized too, a mortgage, right? And you know, the other thing is that when you talk about student debt, there are less markers to evaluate a person's credit worthiness because they're 17 years old, you know, they don't have any credit history. And if you look at, like, if you just want to compare it to the last bubble, because the student loan bubble is like $1.3 trillion in debt right now, and it's about to burst. The last bubble we went through was the housing bubble. So you take the same ideology of like the Barack Obama type people who say, you know, this is about opportunity. Take it to the housing issue, where 15 years ago, it was actually pretty easy to get a mortgage. Like, I remember there was a guy I worked for at a school, and the director of the school was like, go buy a house. And I was like, I make $32,000 a year. How am I going to buy a house? And he's like, anybody can buy a house, right? And this was 2003. I think anybody can buy a house. And he was right. Anybody could buy a house because it was about prioritizing opportunity over what made sense economically, right? That was the ideology that was in play. It was so much in play that an entire financial services industry developed around betting those mortgages were going to fail. Right. With like credit default swaps and all that. Like, people saw what was happening and was like, let's create a whole side industry here that just bets on the failure of this. And they were right. I mean, and it screwed the whole system for sure by 2008. But same idea with student loans. The default rate on student loans is it's actually not as bad as I thought. I think it's around like 10 or 12% of all student loans are in default currently. Total student debt is, like I said, over $1 trillion. That default rate should increase as college seems to be less a contributing factor to professional success for people today. But I think the point is there probably are a lot of ideological drivers behind things that have to do with equality and opportunity, because plenty of people got mortgages that shouldn't have got mortgages because it was about equality and opportunity, not what made good sense economically. Student debt is the same thing, except you have fewer markers to evaluate people by, right?
Yeah.
No credit
history. Because there's no history there.
And you can't go in and say, all right, well, let's see your report card. Because that, again, is taking away from equality and opportunity. You're going to deny somebody their dreams just because they couldn't get good grades. And there actually is some reevaluation of the student loan process where many students might have to maintain like a certain GPA to keep getting the loans. But also, that's a total BS metric, because getting good grades in college does not have anything to do with how successful you're going to be professionally, right? If you can get all A's in your gender studies courses, that's fine. There's no jobs for that, except maybe being a blogger for Slate or Salon for $25,000 a year.
Yeah, we not to diverse, but yeah, we my wife and I, we bought an apartment in 2005 in Spain, and we weren't even working at the time. You know, I mean, they were giving away mortgages. You know, we were young and stupid and just, you know, the drool coming out as we signed. So I had no idea what I was signing. So yeah, I mean, back in that period, we were, you know, I was part of that crowd, and we had a great time with our apartment, and in the end, we got out scot-free. We managed to negotiate with the bank and wrote off our mortgage, is another story in itself, but we got lucky. That's all there is to say about that. Solutions going forward then, Brett, you've got the university going on.
Yeah, I think that while I don't see that as obviously a solution to the entire problem, it was important for me to be able to put like a more legitimate foot forward as far as like what we offer as an alternative to traditional education. And that this is a representation that people can, and obviously, you know, this is nothing new. This has been going on for 10 or 15 years online with like, you know, the online course movement and all that. But I wanted some contribution to that, right? Like, yeah, we make free podcasts that have all this great helpful content in it, but I wanted to distill it into something that was, you know, a little bit more compact, a little bit more focused on something specific. And then I want to do that again with another topic. So the first one we did, based on audience polling, people said they wanted better research skills. So I said, okay, you know, there's that feature of it. How do we acquire information most effectively? How do we synthesize information most effectively? How do we communicate information most effectively? So that's what I tried to build into this first summit. And we put it live online October 11th, I think, for that weekend. I emceed it. So I kind of jockeyed all the pre-recorded presentations. I did Q&As in between the presentations. I brought speakers back to do Q&As with audience members who wanted to ask them stuff. And it was a huge success. I'm going to encore the first one, and then I'm going to start working on the second one shortly after that. So I want to build up a course library that is, like I said, a distillation of all the great podcast work that we've done. And I think, you know, a lot of people have helped me with that. I've had a lot of really great, really generous and knowledgeable guests on this show. So the summit was about bringing some of those people back and having them give very focused presentations on this very focused topic. And that's a repeatable thing. I hope to have, you know, 10 of those done within the next 3 years.
So you're going to do an encore of the research skills and then a second one, what, maybe in the spring?
Second one probably around April or May, I'm hoping.
Yeah, cool. And do you have any idea what it's going to focus on?
I do. I would actually like to do one on Nathaniel Brandon's Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, but there's probably some legal hoops to jump through since that is, you know, Nathaniel Brandon's intellectual property and there are guardians. Even though he has passed away, there are guardians of his intellectual property. I know my friend Wes got like takedown notices for stuff that he had put on his website a couple years ago related to Brandon. So how do we purvey that content, like those six pillars of self-esteem, without using that language? And the way I wanted to do it, and even if I can't do it as a summit, even if I can't do it as a digital product, I still think it's a very, very worthwhile project to find people who exemplify each pillar. So, for example, the first pillar is living consciously. So what are, like, say, the five best practices that contribute to conscious living, right? Is it some kind of meditation practice? Is it journaling? To go out and find the five exemplars of that and to talk about their most cornerstone habit for that pillar. Who's achieved a high level of success? Who attributes that success to, even if they've never heard of the six pillars, right? To say, like, living consciously is why I've achieved this level of success. And the most important habit I do that helps me have a conscious life is this. Great. That's one topic right there. So maybe instead of like 12 presentations, which I think is what we had in the last one, we have 30 presentations. They're each a half an hour, and people just give, you know, the top five skills for the top five practices for each of the six pillars. I would love to do that.
Fantastic. Because yeah. You did have an episode, was it about a month ago, about the six pillars, or was it longer ago than that? But one of your more recent episodes, you do have a conversation with about the six pillars of self-esteem.
Oh, I feel like I talk about it all the time. It always comes up. It came up in a mastermind, one of the autonomy masterminds that I do every Tuesday.
Yeah.
Came up, I think, in the one I just released. We talked about it for a while.
Yeah, it's so cool, the autonomy class, what's going on. That's another solution. You know, we've got your universities going on, and then you're also an affiliate with the autonomy class with Richard Grove, and now Jim Hood's Test Drive Your Future class, which is a possible solution for people in their teens, reaching that teenage time when they're looking for alternatives to education. And then in the meantime, you've got your other show going on. Help me out here.
What's it about? I feel like I have a few other shows going on.
With your Danny? Buddy, The Discomfort Zone.
Discomfort Zone. Sure. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. You've got that going on. What else? What else is going on with Brett Vinat?
So The Discomfort Zone has been one. It's a show we do for supporting listeners, and it's me and one of my best friends, and we talk about personal and professional challenges in a very real way that. You know, I would say I'm not comfortable releasing that to thousands of people. So we make it, an incentive to support the show so we can keep producing all of the public content that we make and maintaining the public content that we make. I do a show with Danny McCarthy called In Pursuit of Utopia, which is, a collection of topics that I love. I love talking about history, but it doesn't really fit into my content scheme. It's kind of a little bit off message. So I make that a bonus presentation. Danny and I try to do that every month. We're meeting about the next one today. The Autonomy Mastermind every Tuesday, that's available to my supporting listeners. That's a lot of fun. It's like a group discomfort zone. Like, people always do share and ask questions and bring problems. The one we did last night was awesome. We actually ran long by like a half an hour, and I was happy to do it. I thought there were some new participants who had, you know, some really great questions and contributions. I do a film analysis show with my friend Dutch that's called The Picture of the Month Club. So far, it's kind of played out to be obscure films by great directors And then we wound up doing Mad Max Fury Road, which I put out as a regular podcast. So if people want to see what the Picture of the Month Club is, they can go find that in my feed. Yeah, I want to produce more content. I want to produce different types of content. I couldn't have imagined such designing such an ideal job for me when my professional career started. I didn't do it, you know, completely deliberately or completely consciously, but every place I went and every job I had, I learned something new about myself and about schooling versus education, and just continue to modify my career until it is what it is today. And I've started to feel like, well, it's kind of been this for a little long, and it needs to kind of modify and improve and evolve again. So that's what I'm working on for 2020. But it probably means a lot of public experimentation, which is always a little nerve-wracking. But at this point, whatever. I'm used to being nerve-wracked.
Well, you've built such a strong program anyway. You've got a bit of flexibility there to go wrong, and people will definitely forgive you. I know I will.
Oh, thank you.
You know, thanks to you, I'm never going to try a dopamine fast.
Yeah, don't.
You
do
tried
that.
It for all of us. And I'm really enjoying your series with Daniel McCarthy as well. You know, he's a fellow autonomizer. I know him quite well. I've interviewed him twice myself. Brilliant mind. I'm really looking forward to his book coming out about utopia. Mm-hmm. There's so much going on right now. It is very exciting. And Brett, your work has been invaluable to so many people and myself. And I'm really excited to see what you've got going forward. It's going to be good.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the encouragement. Thanks for having this conversation with me. And I would look forward to doing it again sometime in the future.
Excellent, Brett. Well, I'll let you go. Just a real quick, just in case anyone from outer space doesn't know your work, who's the first time they've heard you, what is your website? Just a quick plug-in.
Thank you, because outer space is the next market that we're trying to go for, so thanks for reminding me. SchoolSucksProject.com is the website, and through there you can see right at the top of the page there's links to all our social media. We have a YouTube page. The username is SchoolSucksPodcast. I don't do much with YouTube currently, but there's a video series that I produced years ago called The Underground History of American Education, based on John Taylor Gatto's book of the same name. And I think it's like 15 pretty short videos, very digestible and very shareable. And if you know somebody who is starting to have doubts about school, or somebody that maybe you've butted heads with on the issue of education, these are very transmittable ideas through this video series that I'm very proud of. I think it's some of the best work that I've done. So School Sucks Podcast on YouTube, and you'll see that playlist right at the top.
Fantastic, Brett. All right. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me, and I'll see you on Discord.
Awesome. Thank you, Chris.